On the morning of June 7th, 1997, 26-year-old Lori Beauvais had dinner with her husband and her sister at Red Lobster in Lakewood, New York. Around 12 hours later, her husband reported her missing, claiming she left their apartment in the middle of the night to go for a walk and smoke a cigarette. She was never seen or heard from again. Nearly 29 years later, Lori's disappearance remains unsolved, and her family is still searching for her. Hey everyone, welcome back to Detective Perspective. My name is Derek Levasseur. I'm a licensed private investigator and former police detective. Each week I'll be covering an unsolved case in story format. I'll then give you my perspective on the investigation and provide contact information for the individuals or organizations connected to the case so that if you have any tips, you can contact them directly and maybe you can help solve a case. So if you're someone who's interested in true crime, specifically unsolved cases, and you would like to hear my opinion on those investigations, please consider subscribing, whether you're watching on YouTube or listening on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or whatever platform you use. All right, Lori Beauvais. This case may sound familiar to some of you if you've been with me since the beginning, because between 1997 and 2008, three women went missing in Chautauqua County, New York, and one of them was Lori Beauvais, who we're going to talk about tonight. There was also Yolanda Bendix and Corey Anderson. And so if you've been with me, then you already know that I covered Yolanda's story. That was episode number 3. And I covered Corey's story as well. That was episode 65. And here we are. I haven't covered Lori's story yet. I'm going to do it tonight because although I think there are more prominent theories in all three of these cases, we have to consider the possibility due to the proximity that maybe they're connected. Maybe there's someone who's involved with all three of these cases and we just haven't identified them yet. But that's up to you to decide. I'm going to cover all the facts. We're going to talk about the case, and then we'll come to our own conclusions, and I will as well. I have a few theories I want to talk about here, and we'll discuss them, and then I'll wait to hear your comments on it. And I will say that out of all three of these cases, I do wish Lori's case had a little bit more meat on the bone, a little bit more information, so we could develop a more thorough opinion on what transpired and what may have taken place here. But we have what we have, and there is a person of interest and an insane twist in this story. So with that out of the way, let's dive into this week's case. Lori Cecy was born on November 26, 1970 to her parents Jim and Sue. She grew up in Chautauqua County, New York with her sisters Renee and Jennifer. Family members described Lori as someone who brought people together. She had a great personality and was always fun to be around. She was easygoing, selfless, and funny, and she had a way of making people feel better when they were down. After graduating high school, Lori began dating Tyrone Beauvais. Both of them were 19 years old at the time, and their relationship continued for several years until July 15, 1995, when Lori and Tyrone got married. Even after getting married, Lori stayed extremely close with her family. She spoke to her sisters and mom every single day. At one point, Lori and Tyrone moved to North Carolina so that Tyrone could attend the police academy. He did not complete the training, so they returned to Chautauqua County, where they settled into an apartment on New York Avenue in Lakewood. Tyrone began working as a contractor, and Lori took a job at Kay Jewelers, where her sister Jennifer also worked. By the summer of 1997, Lori and Tyrone were preparing for several major milestones. They were scheduled to close on a house on June 30th, and just 2 weeks later on July 15th, they would celebrate their second wedding anniversary. They were also talking about starting a family. Unfortunately, none of that would end up happening. On the evening of June 7th, 1997, Lori went to dinner with Tyrone, her sister Renee, and Renee's husband. The group ate at the Red Lobster on Fairmont Avenue in Lakewood to celebrate Renee's promotion. According to WGRZ, Renee recalled that Lori seemed tense throughout the evening. At around 10:30 p.m., the couples left the restaurant and returned to their homes. Lori's family would never see or hear from her again. At approximately 5 a.m. on June 8th, Tyrone called Lori's sister Jennifer and told her that Lori was missing. He said that after dinner, he and Lori had gotten into an argument, and at around 2 a.m., Lori left their apartment on New York Avenue to go for a walk and smoke a cigarette. According to Tyrone, she never came back. And that just didn't make sense to Jennifer. You see, Lori was scared of the dark. She wouldn't even take the trash out at night after they finished a shift at the jewelry store. So to go on a walk in the middle of the night seemed out of the question. So after receiving this call from Tyrone, Jennifer immediately calls her sister Renee to ask if Lori's with her, but Renee tells her no, she's not. So then Renee gets this call from Jennifer and she decides to meet up with Tyrone, and the two of them drove around looking for Lori, but they weren't able to find her. By 11 a.m., there was still no sign of Lori anywhere, so Tyrone reported her missing to the Lakewood Police Department. And this is definitely a story that most of you have heard before, right? I know I have. And not just here on Detective Perspective, wherever you've consumed different cases, whether it's on other podcasts or through legacy media, I know I have as an investigator, right? The typical story, we argued, she or he left, I never saw them again, right? And a lot of people have asked me, when you hear something like this, are you immediately suspicious? And I think it can work both ways, right? On one hand, all depends on perspective, right? I think there are a lot more variables that are involved in this, but just looking at it from the story, on one hand, you could say, well, if this person did something to her, why would they divulge the fact that there was an argument right before she quote unquote disappeared? You know that's going to look suspicious. You know that's going to put a light on you. So why would you do that? If she's already dead, then there's no way she's going to dispute what you're saying. So just say, yeah, we were fine. I woke up. I don't know what happened. But by putting yourself out there and acknowledging that there was some type of disagreement prior to her dropping off the face of the earth, that's not good, right? But on the other hand, you could also say the fact that this person is willing to divulge this to law enforcement, even though it doesn't paint them in the best light, shows a level of transparency and credibility. Even though they know this probably will make them look suspicious, the fact that they're willing to put it out there shows that they want the same thing we want, which is to find their loved one as soon as possible. So I think it's a case-by-case basis. I think there are other variables that come into play when evaluating a level of suspicion from an investigator's perspective. If someone comes in and they're behaving in a certain way that's suspicious, they're not looking at me when they're speaking, they're kind of all scattered brain, maybe they got dirt or cuts on their hands, some other things that add context to this conversation, that may sway me one way or the other. But overall, I'm just going off the basic facts at this point. We have a timeline, allegedly, when this person was last seen, and currently they're missing. That's where you start. And automatically, whether they make this comment or not about having an argument, the last person to see the person we're looking for alive, of course they're going to be on the short list of persons of interest. That's just the nature of the beast. So when law enforcement hears this from Tyrone, they immediately start to search the Beauvais apartment, which is where you would start. You'd start at the foundation, you'd start at ground zero. And according to the Buffalo News, while inside, they noticed several of Lori's personal items had been left behind. Her purse, money, and cigarettes were all still there. And I know what you're thinking right off the jump. Okay, the cigarettes are there, so clearly Tyrone's lying, because if she went to smoke cigarettes, why would she leave her cigarettes behind? You could also say that maybe she took a couple of them with her and she knew she wasn't going to be gone long, so she took them and she left the pack behind. But I'm with a lot of you. I think the fact, even though this may seem minuscule, that the cigarettes were there, I do think it's important. I'm not a smoker. I've never been a smoker. I know there's probably some smokers watching or listening right now, so I want your opinion on this. Please weigh in. If you're going for a walk and you know you're only going to smoke a cigarette or two, are you taking the whole pack and putting the rest in your pocket? Are you taking one or two cigarettes and leaving the pack behind? What is the normal practice here? I know it's not going to be the same for everyone, but I'm truly interested in getting your perspective on this, because to me, if I'm going to take gum, I usually take the pack and stick it in my back pocket. I don't take one stick of gum unless I know I'm going to chew that gum for 2 seconds and then I'm going to be right back. But if I know I'm walking around for a little bit or going out, I'm going to take the whole pack with me. Is that the same for cigarettes, or am I looking too much into this, right? I also don't want to glance over the fact that her purse and money were there as well. In totality, with the purse, the money, and cigarettes, these are things that you would take if you didn't plan on coming back. If she had told Tyrone that she was leaving to go smoke a cigarette, but in reality she was taking off and was never going to come back again, I would think that she would have taken at minimum the money and probably the cigarettes. But she took nothing. So when we're talking about potential theories, and one of them being that she just left under her own free will and her intent was never to return, I think this piece of information, this evidence, if you will, puts a big dent in the possibility that this is what transpired. In addition to her purse, money, and cigarettes, Lori's black two-door 1989 Cutlass Oldsmobile Supreme was also parked at the apartment, and her sister noted that it had been clean when they went to dinner, but now it was dirty. So what does this mean? How deep do we look into this? Again, we don't have a lot to go off here, so let's dissect that a little bit. Renee saying that at dinner the car was clean, now it's dirty. There's always a possibility that she's misremembering. Renee could be wrong. Or if she's right, it could play into one of the theories we're going to discuss at the end of the episode. We'll get there. Despite everything I've just told you, police didn't find any clear signs that a crime had occurred. And that makes sense when you really think about it. Yes, we have items that were left behind that would suggest Lori didn't leave on her own. She wasn't just taking off. But just because we have evidence to suggest that's not what occurred, it doesn't mean because we've ruled out that theory, automatically she was a victim of a crime or that there was foul play involved. You would usually look for a sign of struggle or some indication that the scene was cleaned up prior to law enforcement's arrival, and it doesn't appear that we have that. However, even with the absence of that type of evidence, a wide-scale search for Lori began. And for weeks, her family and multiple police departments searched extensively. Police used boats and dive teams to search Chautauqua Lake, a helicopter search from the air, and dogs searched on the ground. But even with all these resources being deployed, there was no sign of Lori anywhere. We have a lot more to cover. Stick around. We'll be right back after the break. You've heard me talk about Hungry Root before, so you know how much I love it because it truly simplifies my life. As a busy parent who works a lot of hours, it's been such a game changer when it comes to reaching my health goals by doing all of my weekly food shopping with Hungry Root. Hungry Root plans all of my meals and groceries for the week, fills my cart, and delivers everything I'll need to eat healthy every day, all while fitting my health goals, dietary preferences, and budget. I recently told you guys about my favorite meal, which is kind of my go-to. Hey, listen, if it works, why switch it up? And that is the grass-fed ribeye steak, the microwavable ready russet potato. Again, I know some of you are going, wait, a microwave potato? I'm all set. Don't knock it till you try it. It tastes just as good as baking it in the oven. I promise you, once you do, give it a shot. If you've tried it, weigh in the comments down below because I guarantee you can't taste a difference. Then I usually add some cucumbers, and to finish it off, I do the Smart Sweets sweet fish gummies as well. They're basically like Swedish fish, but a little healthier. And they taste, honestly, in my opinion, they taste better. So it's convenient, it tastes good, helps me reach my health goals. What more could you ask for? And unlike other food delivery companies, Hungry Root now offers over 50,000 chef-crafted recipes to choose from every week, with many ready in just 15 minutes or less. And with over 1,000 grocery items like smoothies, sweets, kid snacks, salad kits, ready-to-eat meals, and supplements, it's insanely easy to find options that fit everyone's tastes and nutrition goals. Hungry Root also holds all of its food to high standards, screening out over 200 additives, including high fructose corn syrup, artificial sweeteners, and preservatives. They source only high-quality meat and seafood with no hormones or antibiotics, offer organic produce and non-GMO options, and carry trusted healthy brands like Oatly, Vital Farms, Ithaca Hummus, Harmless Harvest, and many more. You're definitely going to love Hungry Root as much as I do. All you have to do is try it. For a limited time, you can get 40% off your first box, plus get a free item in every box for life. Go to hungryroot.com/detective and use my code detective. That's hungryroot.com/detective, code detective, to get 40% off your first box and a free item of your choice for life. All right, we're back from break, and we were talking about all the resources that were used to try to find Lori, right? We had dive teams, boats, helicopters, dogs, you name it, and yet there was no luck. But while that search was going on, detectives also looked into Lori's bank account and found that there had been no activity since she disappeared, which is telling, right? If she's going to take off and run off alone and just kind of escape her life, you would expect her to maybe withdraw some cash to try to, you know, get around the country to get where she needs to go. It's tough to travel free. It's definitely tough to travel without being noticed by someone. So having that cash may allow you to utilize some resources where you can get further before anybody realizes it. So the fact that there's no bank activity whatsoever, again, another sign that she didn't leave under her own free will. In addition to looking everywhere that they could, including her digital footprint, they also continued interviewing Lori's family, including Tyrone. And at first, he was cooperative. But after a few days, he stopped speaking with investigators. And on June 21st, he hired a criminal defense attorney and said that all questions would need to go through his lawyer. And as you might expect, that raised some concerns for Lori's family. They began looking back at Tyrone's behavior during the search before she was reported missing to police, and some things really stood out to them as red flags. Lori's sister Renee said, quote, "I remember him stopping in front of a garbage dumpster. He asked me to look in the dumpster because when we find her, it may not be good. I remember the sick feeling I had in my stomach and how scared I was to be in the car alone with him after he said that. I hadn't yet come to accept that Lori could have gotten in harm's way." And I gotta try to stay objective here, right? I know the signs are on the wall, right? You have to look at Tyrone as a primary person of interest, right? But let's go back to the fact that he got an attorney. And I talk about this all the time with you guys. And I know when you first hear it, you're automatically going to say, oh, that's guilty, right? That doesn't look good. But we've also talked about the fact that as the person who last saw her and has already acknowledged that they got in a fight before she disappeared, if he's not responsible for what happened to her, he still knows that everyone's going to think he did. So he runs the risk every time he speaks to law enforcement that he could say something that he's when he's trying to be truthful, and yet it causes him to be charged with a crime that he didn't commit. And so I understand the hesitancy, and I understand wanting to have an attorney present when speaking to law enforcement. However, I can only speak for myself. If you love this woman, like we all believe that you do, you should want to find her as much, if not more, than anybody else. And the best chance you have at finding her is through law enforcement. So wouldn't you want to work with them together collaboratively to try to bring your wife home as soon as possible? It's okay to have a lawyer there. Make sure they're protecting you. But at the same time, you might hold the key to finding your wife. You may hold the key to bringing Lori home. And yet you shut off all communication? I don't agree with it. I think it's the wrong approach. And as far as the comment made around the dumpster, it's tough. It's tough for me to put myself in Renee's shoes. I have to take what she said at face value. If that's what he said and how he said it, that again is suspicious to me, right? Like, yeah, you might be thinking it, but why would you say that out loud before even going to law enforcement? Remember, this would have been during the time where Tyrone called Jennifer, Jennifer called Renee, and then Renee met up with Tyrone. So this is really early on where you would think that more than likely Lori's just out somewhere, maybe at a casino or a bar or something, or hanging out with friends. I wouldn't automatically go to the place of, oh, she could be in a dumpster by this point. It's only been a few hours. So that is suspicious to me. And I can understand why Renee would be a little uneasy about being alone with him, not knowing if the whole reason they're out looking for Lori is because of Tyrone. And now she's sitting in a car with him. So her thoughts and her fears and her concerns are absolutely warranted. However, there's still a possibility that Tyrone had nothing to do with what happened to Lori. There's also a possibility he had everything to do with it. And because Tyrone had chosen not to work with law enforcement, by the end of June, there were rumors swirling around town that Tyrone could have been responsible for Lori's disappearance. And police decided to address those rumors publicly. They told the media that Tyrone had not been charged with anything and that he was not a suspect. However, they also said the decision to hire an attorney was slowing down the investigation. One detective said, quote, "It's his constitutional right to have an attorney, but we are kind of mystified by it in this case. There is no evidence of any crime at this point." And I know exactly what this detective is saying without saying it. This is a clear example of reading between the lines. On one hand, they're saying he is not a suspect. On the other hand, they're saying his behavior is extremely suspicious. Like, why wouldn't this guy want to work on finding his wife when there's no indication of a crime? This looks like a clear accident or something that happened that was outside his control. We're completely mystified by the fact that he wouldn't want to work with us. This is one of the clearest examples of them covering their asses and also trying to put Tyrone at ease by saying, Tyrone's not a suspect. But at the same time, they're also acknowledging that they too believe his behavior is extremely suspicious considering the circumstances of this case. And so it's a little bit of cat and mouse, a strategic approach, if you will, but make no mistake about it. There was an internal discussion before making this public statement, and they knew exactly what they were saying without saying it. At the start of August, Lori's family was still searching for her every single day. They were also offering a reward, hoping it would lead to answers. Lori's mother, Sue, spoke to the Associated Press and said, quote, "Each day gets harder and harder. It's not going to be the same until we find Lori." By that point, Lori still had not used her bank account, and because of that, police said they were beginning to suspect foul play. But they still did not have any evidence to explain what may have happened to Lori. They said her disappearance, quote, "appears to be very suspicious." Detectives continued interviewing and re-interviewing Lori's family and friends, well, at least the ones who were willing to speak with them. Police told the Associated Press that Tyrone had stopped communicating with everyone. Not only was he refusing to speak with police, he was now refusing to speak with her family, which, as you can imagine, was extremely upsetting. So, the investigation continued, but there was still no sign of Lori anywhere. And it would be about a year and a half before there was what appeared to be a major break in the case and an unexpected turn of events. We're going to talk about it right after the break. Ever wake up sweaty, freezing, or just uncomfortable? The temperature in your bedroom can make or break your sleep. That's why I switched to Miracle Made Sheets. They're inspired by NASA technology and use silver-infused temperature-regulating fabric to help you sleep at the perfect temperature all night long. So if you're a hot sleeper, cold sleeper, it doesn't matter. These sheets help keep you in the right comfort zone so you can get a great night's sleep. I can tell you, I have definitely been woken up because I've been too hot. I've never had that issue with Miracle Made. And thanks to their antibacterial silver technology, Miracle Made sheets stay cleaner and fresher up to 3 times longer than regular sheets. That means fewer odors, fewer wash cycles, and way less laundry. And the most important part, at least in my opinion, is that they have to be comfortable, right? Like if you're going to be sleeping on them, all those other things I just said, it really doesn't matter if you don't like how they feel. And I'm happy to report they feel just as good, if not better, than sheets you'd find in some 5-star hotels, but without the steep price tag. So they're smooth, they're breathable, and they're insanely comfortable. They're also great for your skin. All that hidden bacteria you can find in regular sheets, it can clog your pores, it can cause breakouts, and who's looking for that? Not me. But with Miracle Made's antibacterial design, it helps you sleep cleaner and clearer night after night. So upgrade your sleep or give the gift of better rest by going to trymiracle.com/detective to try Miracle Made sheets today. You'll save over 40%, and when you use my promo code DETECTIVE, you'll get an extra 20% off plus a free 3-piece towel set. They make an amazing gift, and with their 30-day money-back guarantee, there's no risk. That's trymiracle.com/detective at checkout. Thanks to Miracle Made for sponsoring this episode. All right, we're back, and in January of 1999, the Chautauqua County District Attorney's Office received a call from a man claiming that human remains would be found along the expressway near Falconer. He said the remains belonged to Lori Beauvais. Investigators responded to the area and located a skull along with several other bones. The remains were collected and sent off for testing. But according to the Associated Press, it was quickly determined that the remains did not belong to Lori. They were from an elderly woman who had died 85 years earlier. As it turns out, the entire tip had been a ruse. The tipster was a prisoner and a career con man who had made the call in an attempt to get an early release. As part of the ruse, he had arranged for 2 friends to steal skeletal remains from a mausoleum and place them along the roadside. He told those friends he would pay them using part of the $10,000 reward being offered by Lori's family. He then called the district attorney's office and told investigators they could find Lori near the expressway. And this is just the lowest of the low, but not surprising. And that's why you can never take anything at face value and you have to vet every piece of evidence, every lead that you get, regardless of how likely or unlikely it may seem. And you always, as an investigator, have to question the motives of the witnesses. Are they connected to a suspect? Are they too close to the victim? Are they just trying to ingratiate themselves in the case? And unfortunately, there's no floor to how low some people will go for self-serving reasons. Bottom line, I just feel really bad for Lori's family. On one hand, you're happy that it wasn't her, because that means there's still a possibility she's out there somewhere. On the other hand, and I think only they can really speak to this, but I'm sure there's a part of them after this amount of time that maybe they're starting to think she's no longer with us, and finding her would bring some sense of relief that they could reunite with Lori, give her a proper burial, and know that the biggest question they have has been answered, that she's no longer with them and they're never going to get to see or talk to her again, and they can start that grieving process. So to have this and to find out it was just some scumbag trying to capitalize on this for his own gain, I can't imagine the sickness they must have felt. And I really hope that karma got to this guy one way or another. I'm not going to say more than that, but if you guys can read between the lines on what I'm saying here, then you know exactly what I'm trying to convey. So let's fast forward to February of 2000. At that time, detectives provided an update saying Lori's case was still being treated as a missing person investigation. Lori's loved ones and law enforcement also announced a $50,000 reward. And according to the Buffalo News, the hope was that it would re-energize the case, which had not received any new leads in several months. But unfortunately, as far as we know, it's still an open case. The reward did not generate any new tips, and the case began to slow down. In 2007, on the 10-year mark of Lori's disappearance, police spoke again with the Buffalo News. They said they were still continuing to do everything they could to solve this case. Detectives had recently re-interviewed several people, but Tyrone, who had moved to North Carolina, remarried, and had two sons, was still not cooperating. He continued to refuse to speak to law enforcement. Lori's family also spoke with the media. Her mother, Sue, said, quote, "I think about all the years that have passed and everything Lori has missed and what we have missed with her. I feel so blessed for the years Lori was in my life. Lori will be in my heart forever." The search for answers continued, and in 2008, Lori's photo and case information were added to a deck of playing cards distributed in jails, and we've talked about this before. Lori's card was the Ace of Diamonds. Police told the Post-Journal that by this point, they had re-interviewed between 30 and 40 people. Through those interviews, they said they had developed new information and began looking at the case from a different angle. At the same time, they also mentioned again that Tyrone had never helped in the investigation. One detective said, quote, "We've never had any cooperation from Tyrone. He has never assisted us in any way, shape, or form since the beginning." And so you can see what happened here, right? Originally, they were trying to lower Tyrone's guard. They made it very clear that he was not a suspect and they had no evidence of a crime. They even acknowledged that he had a constitutional right to have a lawyer present, but they were still hoping that he would come forward and speak with them and try to bring Lori home. Now that some time has passed, they've turned up the heat, and they're making public statements letting everyone know that the husband of the woman missing has never helped in any way in finding his wife. I don't care who you are, that's a problem. All right, let's jump forward a little bit to June of 2018, because what I'm about to tell you right now is going to shock all of you. I know when I read it for the first time, I couldn't believe what I had just read. So that month in June, Tyrone was in Utah with his wife and their two sons when a vehicle traveling in the wrong lane crashed into them head on. Tyrone, his wife, and one of his sons were killed. The other son survived but was left in critical condition. And regardless of what you think about Tyrone and his decisions not to cooperate with law enforcement, if he is responsible for what happened to Lori, then he got exactly what he deserved. But regardless, this is a tragedy because there were two other people in that car that were killed and another person left in critical condition. I wouldn't wish that on anybody. And there's also a possibility, although it doesn't look good, that Tyrone was completely innocent. And this is just tragic all the way around. So I did not see this coming. And like I said, when I read it for the first time, I said, holy, you know what? I was like, wow, well, that's a problem. And obviously this accident was extremely tragic, but it also complicated things, right? For police who had to investigate Lori's disappearance. And what happened after that accident was interesting, but also confirmed a lot of what I've been telling you throughout this episode. The police chief spoke with Spectrum News One and said Tyrone's death, quote, does dim some of the hope that we were going to solve this. He knew the answers to where she was and what happened to her. He was our person of interest in the case, and he still is, even though he's now deceased. So there you go. There it is for everybody to consume. All along, Tyrone was a person of interest, and clearly he knew that, and that's why he chose not to speak with police. Now, in 2021, I will say, police provided an update to WGRZ, and at this time, they said there were several persons of interest in the case who may have known what happened to Lori or where she might be. They also clarified their stance on Tyrone. They said, quote, we've never considered Tyrone a suspect. He is a person of interest. It is still to this day an open missing persons case. We do not have anything stating otherwise. I didn't take this statement as, oh, we've developed other persons of interest who may be solely responsible for what happened to Lori. I just think that maybe they're almost subconsciously hoping that other people who knew what happened to Lori are still out there somewhere, and so therefore the case isn't dead. Now, them saying that Tyrone is not a suspect, that's not saying anything. Person of interest, suspect, yeah, it's supposed to be a hierarchy. It's supposed to be a raising of the threat level, I guess. But in reality, it's just a term, right? Persons of interest, yeah, they could be responsible. There's someone who could have more information to solve this case. The suspect is someone they believe is directly responsible for what happened. But I will tell you, many agencies use those two words interchangeably. So I wouldn't put too much weight on the fact that they're saying Tyrone is not a suspect. As far as I'm concerned, from what I'm seeing and what I'm hearing, Tyrone's still their primary guy, even in death. And just to make matters worse, by this point, Lori's mother, Sue, had sadly passed away without ever getting answers about what happened to her daughter. Lori's father, Jim, and her sisters remained hopeful that Lori would be found so they could finally have the answers they've been looking for so long. Jim said that no matter how difficult it has been to live without Lori, he was not going to stop searching for her. He said, quote, she was one of the loves of my life, and I'm never giving up. Jennifer spoke about the family's belief that Tyrone was involved. She said, quote, we all know and believe in our hearts who is responsible. Tyrone has all the information. He's not going to jail. That chapter is closed, so we need to find her. We believe maybe somebody has some kind of information out there. Now that Tyrone is dead, maybe they would feel more comfortable coming forward. That's our hope. And this goes along with what law enforcement has already said, right? I do believe that detectives are probably speaking with Lori's family, especially after all these years. And you can see the cohesiveness of the statement, right? They're not exonerating Tyrone. In fact, Lori's family is implicating him, but law enforcement and Lori's family are both kind of saying the same thing. Although Tyrone's not a suspect because they don't have enough to say that, even with Tyrone passing, they're now hoping that Tyrone had accomplices, maybe people who he went to try to assist him in the removal of Lori to make sure that she was never found. And even if these people were friends or family members of Tyrone's, he's no longer here. Nothing's going to bring him back, and there's nothing law enforcement can do to him. So maybe if they can find it in the goodness of their hearts, they can come forward and provide Lori's family with the information they need to finally bring her home. Now, the hesitancy would be, hey, listen, if I come forward and say, I know where she is because I helped bury her body, could they still be implicated at this time? So what I would add to the statement by law enforcement and Lori's family would say, hey, listen, if you were somehow involved where you got a call from Tyrone or someone else, and they asked you to assist in the removal and the disposal of Lori's body, we're not going to press any charges. We may not like you, but you're going to get a pass. There's going to be a plea agreement. You won't get anything. We just want to bring Lori home. Maybe that conversation has already happened and Lori's family's not on board with it, but as hard as it would be for me, as her father, I would make that deal. I would come right out and say, listen, tell us where she is. No charges. Now, karma's still going to get him. And I can't promise you as a dad, I may not do something stupid, but at minimum, there's going to be no criminal charges. I just want to bury my daughter. If that's the case, I want to answer that question. I want her back home with me. I want her next to her mother. So there's still time. They can make that offer, but I would do it sooner than later because a lot of years have already passed. In fact, in 2025, 28 years had passed since Lori disappeared. The police chief told WKBW that the investigation was still open, and he also spoke about how frustrating it has been not to have answers both for investigators and for Lori's family. Unfortunately, that is the last update we have available in this case. We're coming up on 29 years, Lori is still missing, and her family is still searching for answers. All right, so let's dive into this perspective, and I want to cover a couple things before I get to my theories. First off, obvious question. Friends, family members, acquaintances. Number one thing I'm asking, did she ever go for walks? More specifically, did she ever go for a walk at night, whether she was happy, sad, angry? Ever in your life, family members, have you seen Lori going for a walk? Number one question, is this something she would do? As we know, with smokers, they're creatures of habit, and they're going to replicate something over and over again. It's their stress relief. It's what they do. And so I would expect that if Lori was a walker who, whether she was happy, sad, or frustrated, somebody else would have witnessed this throughout her life. And if nobody has experienced this, then it's hard to believe that on this particular night at 2 o'clock in the morning, Lori Beauvais decided for the first time ever to go for a walk, not to call her sisters, not to call her parents, not to call a friend. She's just going to go out in the dark when she's scared of it and go smoke a cigarette. Highly unlikely if she's never displayed that type of behavior before. The second question that I would have would be for investigators, and that would be, was the apartment, Tyrone's vehicle, and more importantly, Lori's vehicle forensically processed? DNA, trace evidence, hair, blood, fibers, maybe conditions on the outside of that vehicle, right? That would suggest where that car was prior to being located. As I mentioned earlier, Lori's sister believed that the car was clean at dinner, and yet when she saw it, it was dirty. In a couple minutes, when I talk about where Tyrone and Lori exactly lived, you're going to see how whatever was found on the outside of that vehicle could not only tell us what happened to Lori, but where she might be. And that's the forensic side of things. As far as the digital data, we're a little bit more limited, right? We have potentially some cameras, maybe at more commercial buildings. It wasn't as prevalent in residential buildings at that point. Also, cell phone tracking, not really a thing. Cell phones were in existence, but they weren't like they are today. So cell phone triangulation wouldn't really be a thing. And I don't even know if Lori had a cell phone. So that's kind of out at this point. And also, we have to talk about the fact that although there was no sign of a crime in this particular case, what evidence did you have that you haven't conveyed publicly? I would take that and compare it to other cases that I spoke about, Yolanda's and Corey's. Are there any similarities there? Is there anything that you haven't divulged to us that may indicate these cases might be connected? If there were, I would assume at this point that would have come out publicly, and yet it hasn't. And so I'm working off the assumption that's not the case. And I will tell you, after covering Yolanda and Corey's case, I do not believe these three are connected. But again, I'm coming from a surface level perspective. I'm not boots on the ground. The investigators who actually worked this case would know more than me. But if it hasn't been vetted in that capacity where we haven't compared notes with other agencies, that is something that needs to be done and can still be done. And those are some of the main things that I think of after covering this case and kind of doing my own research. That's where I would start. If I was brought in as a PI, these are the questions that I would be asking, and I would try to find ways to still explore them. I don't know where Lori's vehicle is now. I'm assuming it's still somewhere. I would think that Lori's family would hold on to the vehicle. Yeah, there could be some chain of custody issues at this point, but who really cares? If you still have it, MVAC it. Let's see what we find. And you definitely would want to try to take samples of the exterior of the vehicle. Although at this point, 30 years later, it's not going to be worth it. There's just too much contamination at this point. There's no way to determine if what is found on the car actually came from the area where Lori might have been. However, you know, long shots. This is all long shots at this point. And no rock is too small to overturn, right? Any angle we can go with, at this point, what do we have to lose? So let's transition and talk about some of the main theories. And the first one, which I'm going to cover quickly, is that Lori left on her own. She said she was going out to smoke a cigarette, was fed up with life, and just took off because she didn't want to be found. I can't say with 100%, but I'll say with 99%, that's not what happened here. She had a loving family, a lot to look forward to. If this was just a surface level argument, she would have went out, smoked her cigarette, and she would have been back. So that's really all I have to say about that theory. I'm covering it because I can't definitively rule it out. But if I had $1 million right now, I would put it on that's not what happened. The second theory is that she did go for a walk to smoke a cigarette. And while out there, she encountered someone who presented themselves as a friendly, maybe driving a car or walking as well. And in reality, they had malicious intentions. And within a moment's notice, they could have attacked her, threw her into a vehicle, threw her into a structure. And unfortunately, Lori is no longer with us. Although there's nothing to support that, I can't sit here from a professional standpoint and tell you that's not possible. All this time, people could be thinking it's Tyrone when in reality, this is exactly what happened. And it could explain why the case has never been solved. Because we don't have any connective tissue between Lori and her attacker, it's really hard to put that case together. You're basically starting with a stranger who had no previous encounters with Lori, and therefore it's a guessing game. You really need a witness to come forward or some type of forensic evidence found on Lori in order to identify the suspect. So without Lori, that's damn near impossible. The second and third theory that I want to talk about are the same but also different. One being that while driving home from the restaurant or upon arriving home, there was an argument that ensued. And during that argument, whether it was intentional or accidental, Lori was severely hurt or even killed. And at that point, Tyrone realized that he was in a lot of trouble. And if he didn't do something about it, he was going to go to prison for the rest of his life. So at that point, he decided to dispose of Lori's body. And when we think about the time frame, and we're going to talk about that in a couple minutes after I cover this theory, because I think it's really critical to this case. He disposes of Lori's body and then decides to call Jennifer to make it appear as if, hey, Lori said she was going for a walk to smoke cigarettes. I woke up or whatever, and she's gone and I don't know what's going on. I'm as clueless as you are. You want to present yourself as an innocent party. But as we're going to talk about in a few moments, if we're to believe that they left the restaurant at 10:30 and he didn't make that first call to Jennifer until 2, that's a 3.5 hour window. A lot can happen in that period of time. Another possible avenue with that same theory, because it involves the same people, is that most of what Tyrone has told law enforcement is true. They get home. There's an argument, a serious argument. Lori decides to leave, whether it's to go to someone's home or to really go smoke a cigarette. And while she's out there, Tyrone's extremely upset. Maybe there's more to the story than we know. Maybe he was assuming that she was seeing someone else. And when she leaves the house, he thinks that she's going to see that person. So he tracks her down. The argument continues. It potentially escalates and it leads to him hurting or killing Lori. And then the same thing unfolds. He has to dispose of her body. And after doing so, he gets back home, calls Jennifer, and everything that we know from that point forward takes place. And so on that note, I want to talk about where the Red Lobster was, where they lived, and how much time passed, because it could give us an idea of what could be accomplished in that window. So I looked up the Red Lobster on Fairmont, and in fact, it's closed. RIP Red Lobster. Although you guys corrected me last time, there are still some Red Lobsters out there. I said a few episodes ago, a while back, oh, Red Lobster's out of business, and you guys hammered me for it. God forbid, there's still some Red Lobsters out there. They're still in existence. Thank God, I love my cheddar biscuits. But now I believe the location is a Olive Garden. And what's important is not that the Red Lobsters are still out there. It's that this location is about a 4-minute drive to New York Avenue where their apartment was. And what's even more important than that is that if you look on the map here, and I have it up on the screen, you can see the drive from the Red Lobster, i.e. Olive Garden, to New York Avenue, where the apartment was. And initially, if you look south, it is a residential area. It's not a densely populated area, but there are still houses, although there are a lot of woods as well. And so something easily could have happened to Lori in one of these locations, and she could have been disposed of or buried in a manner where nobody would be able to find her. However, if you look further north, you have the Chautauqua Lake. And when you think about how vast the Chautauqua Lake is, even though they had boats and dive teams out there, if there's anything that I've taught you guys over the years, even though they have all the resources available, it's very easy to lose a body in the water. It's the literal definition of a needle in a haystack. Some of these lakes are extremely deep, and there's a lot of debris and vegetation at the bottom of these lakes, and it would be easy for a victim's clothing to be caught up on something or for them to be weighted down and for them to never rise to the surface. And so when you think about that lake being in such close proximity to where they lived on New York Avenue, if something were to have happened to Lori inside the apartment or right around the apartment, it would be a very short walk to that lake or an even shorter drive. And that's where her vehicle comes into play. If Renee is right about the condition of the vehicle, was there any type of vegetation or debris or even rocks that were located around the Chautauqua Lake that could have been located on the outside of her vehicle or inside one of the tire treads? These are things with Renee's testimony that could have been critical to this case. If she was willing to go on the record and give a statement saying that car was clean when I last saw it at dinner and now it's covered in debris, and they were able to connect or associate something found on the exterior of that vehicle being at the lake within the 3.5 hour window that Lori was missing, well, then that's relevant. That could tell us what happened. And it wouldn't make sense that Lori would take off to go smoke a cigarette, come back, get her car, take her car to the lake, drop it back off, then disappear. And that to me would be an indication that a crime had been committed. And maybe that would have changed the trajectory of this case. And if that is what happened here, then that would mean that Lori was hurt or killed inside the home and then disposed of in the lake. And if you look at that map one more time here, you can see all the residences and all the docks. And I would like to think that someone would have heard or saw something. It may not be a smoking gun where they saw someone dumping a body in the lake. I would like to think that person would have come forward by now. But it could be someone who was there at the time and witnessed a suspicious vehicle that was parked in the area of the lake for a short period of time, maybe even an Oldsmobile, if we're lucky. And you see how something that they thought was not important, not relevant, now becomes a critical part of the case. And so we got to hold out hope that there's a witness out there, or as the family's hoping, somebody who may have assisted in whatever happened to Lori. So just to recap, Lori Beauvais was last seen on the evening of June 7th, 1997, at the Red Lobster on Fairmont Avenue in Lakewood, New York, having dinner with her husband, her sister, and her sister's husband. Her husband, Tyrone, claimed that after they got home from dinner, the two got into an argument, and at around 2 a.m., Lori left their apartment to go for a walk to smoke a cigarette. She has never been seen or heard from again. Anyone with information regarding Lori's disappearance is asked to call the Lakewood Police Department at 716-763-9563. My final words, as always, go out to the friends and family of Lori, specifically Jim, Renee, and Jennifer. I know a long time has passed, but I also know you will never stop looking for Lori. And I want you to know you're not alone. It can feel like you are sometimes, especially when law enforcement appears to have moved on from the case because they have other investigations they have to work. What we can do is make sure that nobody forgets Lori's name and continue to spread the story of what happened to her to build a community of people who feel as connected to her as you do. And I'm just trying to be a small part of that. I want you to know if there's anything that I can do or we can do to help you, we are here, we are fighting for you, and I hope I get the opportunity to let everybody know that Lori has been found and you finally have the answers you've been looking for. Until then, everyone stay safe out there, and I'll see you soon.